This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 361 was produced on February 2nd, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Hunte Investments fund manager Alex Gurevich returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss this week's FOMC statement and press briefing, inflation, crude oil, interest rates, equity markets, and precious metals.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Alex, when Eric, Nick, and I will discuss the post-FOMC charts on the S&P 500, NASDAQ, VIX, gold, oil, and more. Eric, before we move on to the feature interview with Alex, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a massive 4.1 million barrel build this week, and finally, no SPR drawdown. Now, that was against expectations of a small drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 2.3 million barrels. Gasoline, building 2.6 million barrels. Distillates, building 2.3 million barrels. U.S. production unchanged at 12.2 million barrels. So, builds across the board. This was the sixth build in a row on the EIA data series, and for the last 5 weeks, we've had some pretty significant builds, which normally would be bearish, but the market was just holding on to prices, seemingly ignoring inventory data completely. Well, for some reason this week, the market got the memo. I guess the sixth time's the charm or something like that. Perhaps it was OPEC Plus also agreeing to hold their policy steady that helped. But after the inventory, we saw a very, very steep sell-off in crude oil prices. A little bit of a bounce on the FOMC statement, which obviously was more dovish than people expected. And perhaps maybe ignited hopes that the Fed has successfully achieved a soft landing. I'm still a skeptic on that. In any event, I'll discuss crude oil more with Alex Gurevich in today's feature interview.
Now, this week's feature interview guest is Hunte Investment Fund Manager Alex Gurevich. Eric, why did we invite Alex on as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Alex is a favorite guest of our listeners. He's a very strong macro guy with a fixed income focus. So we thought on an FOMC week, made sense to get a fixed income guy and particularly one with Alex's perspective. It's also been quite a while since we had him on the show, so I was keen to get him back on.
Eric's interview with Alex Gurevich is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Hunte Investments fund manager, Alex Gurevich. Alex, it's great to get you back on the show on this Fed day. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon, just minutes, well, maybe an hour after the Fed made their announcement that they hiked 25 basis points as expected. There was also a Fed press briefing, and as Jay Powell began speaking, you actually tweeted in reaction to something he said. Please tell us about that.
Okay, well, it's good to be back. It's always fun to be talk to you, Eric. And yes, I am rather puzzled, honestly, by what the Fed is doing. I try to listen carefully to their press conferences, and honestly, it does not make a lot of sense to me, and I'm usually not the person to criticize the Fed. So he started his press conference release with the following statement. The consequences of our tightenings, the full consequences of all our tightenings are yet to be felt. And I could not agree more with that statement. Because of the policy lag, we could not possibly be right now experiencing the consequences of all the tightening that has occurred over the last year. Now, even without the full effects of those tightenings, we're seeing inflation, every possible measure of inflation decelerating and coming down. And the biggest input actually to estimate future inflation is inflation itself. So as inflation is coming down, it creates less and less momentum for future inflation. And meanwhile, the tightening is yet to feed through the system. I really do not understand in what possible universe people could be concerned about inflation at this stage and not deflation. And I know I'm sounding very forceful. Everything in the markets is a probabilistic statement. So when I say things with such force and such confidence, all I mean is that one is, in my opinion, more likely than the other. Of course, any of the outcomes are possible. But why people right now worry about inflation more than deflation totally eludes me. Maybe you can help me with that a little.
I sure can, because I'm one of them. And I very much value your perspective, Alex. So please help me understand what I'm missing, because here's how I see it. The big wave of inflation, which was the combination of pandemic supply chain effects and changing macro backdrop, created this just super spike of inflation. That's behind us. I don't think it's coming back. But at the same time, I think it's crazy to think you're going back down to 2%. I think we'd be lucky to get down to 4%. And I think, you know, maybe 4.5 or 5% is more likely. And the reasons that I say that is I think the world has changed dramatically. We used to have this globalized world where we got all kinds of cheap stuff from China, and we didn't really have to worry about the fact that it was all coming from other economies where people have much lower standards of living. Now we're moving to a multipolar economy, a multipolar global geopolitical regime, if you will, where maybe China's our enemy. Maybe we're not going to have trade relations with China long term. We're talking about reshoring a lot of critical industries, and I can't see how that's possibly cheaper. Meanwhile, something I definitely, you know, given what you're saying, I really want to talk to you later about crude oil, because I think that the world is out of spare capacity. I think oil prices are set to move much higher, not necessarily right this instant. We could still see another wave down, but eventually we're going to realize that we're out of spare capacity. Oil prices are an input cost to absolutely everything. So I think that also feeds a secular inflation trend. And I'm not saying we're going to sustain, you know, 9% or 10% or whatever the top of this last cycle was. But I think that there are so many reasons to expect long term that the price of everything goes up as we have to start making things in an economy that is has a higher standard of living for workers, and things are going to cost more. Meanwhile, the commitment to saving the environment and arresting climate change is extremely strong, and that's contributing to this trend of greenflation, where, you know, you want to change the way we do everything and focus on clean energy instead of cheap energy. Okay, well, that means you're paying more for it, and energy is an input cost to everything. So these are all the reasons that I see a secular inflation trend, and it's not the great big huge one that we just went through that was compounded by pandemic effects, but I don't see how you get back down to 2%.
Well, I just to be clear, I'm not talking about going back down to 2%. I'm going into severely negative territory, and I feel it's almost unavoidable in the next couple of years. And I can explain why I think this way, which is, having said that, there are, I think, in terms of the things, there are several interesting things, and especially oil. I want to touch on it in much more depth because I think it's one of the most interesting markets right now in the world. I've never been more interested in oil than I am right now, and I'll explain why. And there are many different forces. So the force of deglobalization, I call it like a mid-horizon force. It's in, and the force of energy transition. This is a mid-horizon force. I think the longer, super secular, incredibly deflationary trend continues. But I think also we are into, right now, heading into extremely strong cyclical deflation. And that's why in my mind, and I will explain what argument in my mind trumps all other arguments. The point is that I'm not an economist, so I cannot break down things and really like separate, oh, we are, or it's like high now, but it's lagging. And this component and services inflation is still strong and goods inflation is coming off. Like I look at all this analysis, I cannot really add anything to that. You can break it down. What is the component of deflation that was exported from China? Was no longer exported from China, now getting again exported from China with reopening. There's so many factors. But what I do understand is how dynamic systems work. A dynamic system is a system which feeds into itself. That is, the previous condition of the system impacts the future condition of the system. And inflation is like that. So the mistake I made in 2021 in underestimating the inflation spike, what was the mistake? It was not just that I, part of it, maybe not understanding fully the problem with supply chains, right? Many people didn't. What I think I did not understand is that how much the impact of profoundly negative real interest rates that we had in 2021 will actually feed into inflation. And really, in retrospect, you make real interest rates minus 9%, people will borrow like crazy, money will be created. So money was created like crazy in 2020 and 2021. It takes a long time to work through this such insane amount of money creation. And no kidding, it created inflation. Now, somehow that inflation managed to self-arrest before the Fed even started to really seriously come in the picture and stabilize, despite that strong feedback. And that's probably for the reasons you just mentioned, that the original conditions for the inflation spike, which had to do with supply chains, resolved. That had nothing to do with the Fed. Fed didn't help that. If anything, raising rates doesn't help to solve supply chains, right? But that somehow got solved. But now what we're seeing falling inflation and tightening policy. And that falling inflation, as the money supply shrinks, will inevitably cause the prices to fall in the environment when it's not accommodated. So as inflation is falling and real rates are rising, they are right now actually quite positive real rates already. If you look at them, not on a one-year, year-on-year basis, but where they are currently. And the forward-looking, even if you look at forward-looking real rates, like the real rates on TIPS, which I personally, of course, think will realize much higher than they're currently projected because I think inflation will be much lower. But that's my view. But even if I look where they are, they've traveled a long time higher from like minus 2% to positive 1, positive 1.5%. That's looking for several years out. And in terms of how it is looking on monthly basis, it's extremely high rate. So what I know is that we are on the path of overall inflation going down. And the Fed keeps kicking it down by raising rates and conducting tightening. In the middle of this process, the data, economic data is coming mixed. And I actually want to talk about that too. That would be super fun thing to talk about, the mixed economic data. Economic data is mixed and not everything is straightforward. And for example, right now, the stock market is getting support because Treasury is drawing down ahead of debt ceiling. So liquidity is actually not being hurt too much, but quantitative tightening, but that's like putting money from one pocket into another pocket. Sooner or later, they'll have to restore their reserves and money supply will start tightening again once the debt ceiling is passed. So what I see is you suck dollars out of the system, there will be not enough money to pay for stuff. And that actually very neatly takes me into crude oil thesis, if you would like to go there now.
Let's do it.
So the first thing that I wanna, and paradoxically, the resulting trade might end up being the opposite of my thesis, and I'll explain why. And I actually want to be able to trade against my thesis, and I'll explain why. If you told me which way the oil will go, I probably, if anything, think it might go further down. But if you ask me what is the best trade, I would say you need to be loading up on being long deferred oil. So that's the spoiler.
Long deferred oil, meaning long dated futures contracts?
Yes. And I will explain why. I think I don't need to like repeat to your listeners because you discuss energy a lot. And you had a bit of a discussion with it on a very recent podcast. I don't know, when was the podcast with Lynn Alden? It was not very long ago, right?
Just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so that was very recent when you discussed it. There is really not everybody who knows anything. I'm not an expert on energy, but anybody who knows anything about resources just can point out that there is energy supply at these current prices is not adequate to facilitate global growth. So if you're going to have to have global growth, you're going to have energy prices go up. It's very unlikely that in the next 3 years we'll magically find that much more oil if we're not prospecting for it. It's unlikely that we will just launch fusion reactors in 3 years or even put any huge amount of fission reactors online, right? There is not very likely that there will be very significant change in green energy infrastructure that fossil fuels will go out of style in 3 to 5 years horizon. I think on a longer horizon, I'm not so sure. Changes can happen faster than we expect. But inside 5 years, I'm feeling reasonably there with the crowd. Like, I don't think things will change that much. So I'm just kind of going with a very simple common analysis. It looks like if global growth is to be sustained, energy prices have to go up. However, oil trades in dollars, and dollars are being sucked out of the system. That also cannot be denied. When the Fed conducts quantitative tightening, when the Fed raises rates, it's not a linear process. For example, it was a little like people talked a lot about it. Press conference about the easing of financial conditions. I kind of want to laugh at it because that, to me, that's a tiny blip, this easing of financial conditions. It's just such a small like noise compared to the tremendous tightening of financial conditions that has occurred over the last year. So I don't really think that's such a huge difference, but the overall path is that dollars are getting sucked out of the system. And I think we're already seeing it in behavior that there is not enough money out there in the world to pay for energy. We've seen that, like under stress, certain people are beginning to choose to have less production rather than to pay energy for this production, rather than pay up for energy. So what does it mean? The corollary is that if there won't be enough dollars to pay for oil, the world won't be able to grow. Hence, the world will have to go into global recession. To me, this is almost an unavoidable conclusion. But notice I say if there won't be enough dollars to pay for energy. I think very likely there will be enough dollars to pay for energy because a year from now, the rates will be close to zero and Fed will be thinking about quantitative easing. And 2 years from now, they will be discussing negative interest rate policy. That's my view, right? So and dollars will be created to pay for energy.
Alex, let me take that view to the next step because I think it'll help to illustrate your basic point. And I think it's also interesting to explore some extremes here. Let's suppose that something happens geopolitically that takes half of Russia's oil off the market. Russia exports about 8 million barrels per day. If you take 4 million barrels per day off the market, all of the other oil producers in the world combined don't have anywhere close to enough spare capacity to make up the difference. So you end up with there's less supply. It's not a question of price. There's less supply, period. Now, what most people assume is, oh, wow, if that ever happened, prices would be $500 a barrel overnight. I think what you're saying is, no, what if that ever happened, we'd have a global depression. And it wouldn't be higher prices. It would be a collapse in economic activity. Is that what you're saying? And if so, let's talk about that scenario. I'm not predicting that half of Russia's oil would come off the market. But hey, we're talking about potentially threats of nuclear escalation in a conflict between the world's biggest superpowers, United States, Russia, and China. Anything's possible. We ought to think through the scenarios. So let's imagine that something happens that takes, and it doesn't even have to be Russia, it could be something happens with Saudi Arabia that takes 4 million barrels off the market. If that happened, there is no alternative source to make up for it. Nobody can turn up the screws that much or even close to it. Does that mean prices go up or prices go down?
Well, kind of the simple first reaction, they probably do go up because it's just a simple supply-demand law. Demand will go down, supply will go up. But also that, for example, it's not inflationary if that happens. I think it is deflationary. This will be a deflationary shock for the world at this point. Because if you take that much of supply off the market, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think world can grow, economic growth can continue without energy right this moment.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with that. And I think we do have a setup here. Because, I mean, look at, you've got a whole bunch of celebrities in the UK are very harshly criticizing and petitioning UK banks to completely cease all investment and lending to support investment in new coal fields, oil fields, natural gas. Any kind of energy investment is being decreed as evil. And as long as you have these radical ESG policies that make it a crime to invest in building or sustaining the energy supply that we already have, well, if you don't sustain it, it's going to go down. There's going to be less energy. And I agree with you that that means that we don't have the same kind of economic vitality that we would have had in an environment of low energy prices and ample energy. And we're not going to get ample energy, no matter what we do at this point. Or I should say, if we want to get ample energy, we'd have to have a complete change of policy and attitude. And then there would be a five-year lag time before it would actually get there.
Yeah, sorry, exactly. This is my point. Even if there was a, I'm not an expert on politics, even if there was a change in policy, even if there were some kind of radical shifts, either in terms of new technologies or in terms of changes in policies, I don't think they will have a huge effect inside the five-year horizon.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. So we're in a situation right now, and I've said this for almost a year now on Macro Voices, that I do not believe it is possible for the global economy to return to pre-pandemic growth trajectory, to continue growing like it was before the pandemic, for the simple reason that we don't have enough energy for that to happen. And it doesn't mean, oh gosh, energy is going to be more expensive, but we're going to have the growth anyway. It means we're not going to have the growth because there's not enough energy supply to enable that growth, period.
Yes, so I guess the difference in thesis, you kind of seeing inflationary pressures in the environment of low growth, and what I see is actually deflationary growth collapse. And I want to get back to that in a second, because the jury's out on that. Either of us could be right about this, I imagine. But I want to talk a little bit about oil more in this context, because when you talked earlier, you said that one of your portions of your inflationary thesis is the fact that oil prices, you think, will go up and put pressure on overall inflation, which is true to a certain extent. But I have the following philosophical tenet. When you project something economical, you need to use current market forwards. Now, the current market forward for example, oil 3 years out is in the 60s. It's like $67, $68, whatever. It's sloshing between $65 and $70. Now, if you imagine oil being there, like think about, let's think through scenarios in which, what scenario would make oil be $65 or lower 3 years from now? And I cannot see any scenario that would cause oil to be there where it's currently projected by the market, which does not involve at least a recession and a deflationary recession. Because any inflationary environment I can imagine would also imply oil price being much higher. And I don't know if you agree with this or not.
Hang on a second, Alex, because this is something where a lot of people have differing opinions. Some people think that commodity futures markets, when you look at long-dated contracts, are predicting what the future price is going to be. I'm very much in the other camp myself, which is I don't think it's a prediction of future prices. I think backwardation is actually an indication of the tightness of a market. So actually, the fact that we have very steep backwardation and very low future prices, I see as a bullish sign rather than a bearish sign. Do you see it the other way?
So first I will say I'm probably not enough of an expert on oil market to say whether it's bullish backwardation is bullish and bearish for me, but I will totally agree with you. I do not view forward prices as adequate predictors of future market prices. Otherwise, I wouldn't be trading the markets, because that's the whole point of trading. You think that the forward is at the wrong place and you make money. So in fact, I've been actually talking in a while about how interest rate futures have negative predicting power. That is, forward interest rate futures, typically the higher they are, the lower they end up, and conversely. I've written about this even in my first book, The Next Perfect Trade, about the negative predicting power of futures. So that would probably be very much aligned with this view that you are espousing regarding oil futures. I just didn't study oil futures in the same way, but it sounds about the same kind of similar idea in certain ways. Now, what I'm trying to say is that in the end, of course, my goal is not to be right about economics, but to make money. And what I was trying to say more like, look at the contract. I can buy a contract at $68 for oil about 3 years from now. How am I going to be wrong? In which scenario? To be wrong, it has to be considerably down. I don't care if it's $1 or $2 down. So let's talk about in which case oil can end up being at $50 or $60 a barrel 3 years from now. Given our early discussion, the only situation I can imagine is happening in is the situation that I actually think is likely, but not super likely, that Fed will persist to be tight and we will have a deflationary depression somehow, and Fed will somehow cause it by keeping rates really high and sticking there. It could happen, but is it possible? Basically, what I cannot see is a situation in which oil goes much lower 3 years from now and rates are not zero. What my question to you is, can you imagine a situation, and this is very salient because I know that you follow oil a lot and I know you have certain views on inflation. Can you outline for me the situation in your mind in which oil is significantly lower than predicted? So we lost money on the forward trade, right? Oil trade. We bought oil at $67, held it for 3 years and lost money. And secondly, rates are not zero. Can that be the case 3 years from now?
I think it's a question of relative performance. On absolute terms, I agree with you. If you talk about buying a 3 years out contract in the 60s and then hold it until it expires, are you going to lose money on that trade? I think it's extremely unlikely that you could lose money on that trade. I see that. The reason I think it's not quite so simple as to say you can't possibly lose is simply on a relative performance basis. If you look at that trade versus buying the front month contract, if a certain set of bullish factors that I think are likely in the market happen, the guy who buys the front of the curve is going to see much more upside much more quickly, and the return over time is going to be much higher. So I think what you're doing is you're taking a more conservative, more certain trade that's going to have a lower return for the amount of risk capital that you have to allocate to it over time. So on a relative performance basis, I think that buying closer to the front of the curve gives you more punch, so to speak. But I think your trade is more conservative and more certain to have a positive outcome.
Well, to me, the reason why I really like the trade is because, and it's a matter of style. And as you know, I almost always opt for longer horizon trades on which I have higher percentage of wins, as opposed to shorter horizon trades, which give lower percentage of wins, but hope you can kind of take win or lose and move to the next trade. This is just a matter of style. To me, I like, because when I buy oil spot at say $80 or $78, I can kind of say like, okay, over the next few months, I can make 20 or lose 20, and maybe I'll be right 55% of the time. But if I buy it at 65 for 3 years, I feel like I can possibly double the oil price. But surely 90 is much more likely than 45. Like there is little doubt in my mind that 90 is much more likely than 45. So to me, this is the short-term trade I'm not sure about. The long-term trade, like it seems more speculative. And as you say, I like to be more conservative and just take the trade which is very likely to make money with relatively conservative downside. But the important point I'm making is that if my view is that deflationary depression is going to happen, the only way I can really lose money and the only way I can lose money on the oil trade, if there is a deflationary depression, then if I lose money on the oil, I'll make money elsewhere, say on my interest rate bets. But if I'm wrong on interest rate bets, I think it will always be in the environment when I'm making money on oil. So I feel it's like really good for portfolio purposes right now to be long oil. It's a way essentially to bet on you have positive carry. You can decide on the long horizon, but you have positive carry and you have almost all economic scenarios leading to you making money, and you have good risk symmetry, more upside than downside. And I just don't think you can very often find trades like this in the market.
Alex, let's keep that theme going of talking about trades that are longer term, low chance of loss. It seems to me that you've been a bullish bond guy for quite a while now. We're at not necessarily the exact time top of a hiking cycle from the Fed, but we got to be close to it at this point. You know, they've gone from 75 to 50 to 25 basis point hikes. Maybe there's more hikes coming, maybe there's not, but you know, it's not like we're only halfway there. So is this a time when you want to buy bonds because, hey, the top of the hiking cycle has to be the time to buy bonds? And if so, which bonds do you buy? How far out on the curve? Because the Fed's only actually directly controlling the very front of the curve, but you like longer-term trades. So are you buying the 10-year? Are you buying the 2-year? I mean, what do you buy? And is this Fed cycle an appropriate signal to be trading off of in terms of this is a good time to buy bonds?
Well, first I will say I don't remember ever having an inverted curve and not being a good time to buy bonds.
Okay.
So no, the paradoxically, the more inverted curve is, the more inverted it will be, in a sense that whenever the market prices eases going forward, much more eases than projected always happen. That has been my experience. And people could argue that my experience belongs to a certain era that is over. But I'm just saying my experience has been that whenever there is like any kind of persistent prediction of easing, much more easing and much faster than predicted occurs. So probably, like as you say, in terms of relative performance, I would be long 2 or 3 years out, because that's when I think rates will hit zero personally. But I think it's safe to be long any portion of the curve. Not safe. Safe is not a good word, but I think that's the right trade. And honestly, in my opinion, the mother of all bond rallies is just beginning to wrap her eyes and starting to wake up.
If I wanted to put one trade on right now, which is, look, for the next 5 years, it seems like this is a good time to be going long fixed income for the next 5 years. If that's my objective, how far out on the curve do I go? What maturities do I look at? And why don't we expand it beyond that to, okay, is it just in treasuries? At what level of risk do I want to be exposed to the bond market? Is it corporates? Is it treasuries? Where do I want to be?
You know, within your question lies the answer. I kind of like buying 5-year bonds, if that's what you want to do, as much as you possibly can.
Okay, so it's buy and hold to maturity, which I find interesting, because usually when you have a decreasing interest rate environment, it's better off to buy longer maturity and roll it rather than just hold it till maturity. So you're saying just buy a 5-year bond and let it mature.
Well, you can always, it's a question of how much duration risk you want to have in terms of the total duration. You can have higher notional on 5-year bonds or a smaller notional on 10 or 30-year bonds, but I actually don't mind holding 5-year bonds. Yeah, because we don't know what's going to happen. Like, think about this. I think that rates will go to zero. Like, again, it's my view, right? You're just asking what to do with my view. I think that Fed will taper off their tightening whenever they do. In a few months, they'll start easing. They'll go to zero by the end of 2024 and stay zero for a few years. But can I see that beyond 5-year horizon? Maybe the structural inflationary things that you are talking about will overwhelm the cyclical forces, and inflation will come back and then start hiking again. So sounds like 5 years is about the right horizon. Buy and hold. And in 5 years, you will have no risk once they're rolled off, right? So you'll start the new game again.
Alex, I want to go back to your tweet earlier. You said jokingly, okay, Jay Powell, you ain't kidding that we haven't felt the impact yet of the Fed's tightening cycle. What is the impact going to be? How is this going to affect the economy? How long will it take for that to be felt? And what's that feeling going to be when we get it?
Well, Eric, I had to revise kind of my thinking about the subject a little bit in the last few weeks. And I think a lot of us have to revise it, because what occurred was not exactly the playbook that Fed suggested in 2021 and even 2022. And one of the things that was alluded to in this call and questions that the job market remains very robust. So the playbook is the Fed raises rates, then first domino to fall is asset prices. Check, we've done that. Second domino is economic activity slows down. Kind of check, though data, economic data is mixed. It's slowing down, but not yet showing kind of a broad catastrophe, right? Third domino supposed to fall is employment. And the fourth domino, inflation. This is how like the playbook goes. Now, what we're seeing is that the domino of employment is just refusing to fall. I mean, I don't know what the report is going to be this Friday, but even if it is weak, it could be due to weather. But overall, we're just having... there is just no broad weakness in the labor market. no matter how you look at it. There might be some signs, if you look carefully, for some weakenings here and there, but there is really not yet broad weakness. Meanwhile, we had the other things. Meanwhile, inflation is heading down pretty rapidly. So what is really happening there? And I started to understand that, how do you slow down economy through raising interest rates? By putting pain on people who have low cash balances. But in 2020, 2021, the cash balances for pretty much everybody got pretty high because there was so much cash distributed. So when people have strong balance sheets, raising interest rates is not hurting people very quickly. In fact, they're beginning to earn more interest on their accounts. Maybe not so much on the checking accounts, but here and there, people can start earning more interest in their cash balances. So we're not seeing that kind of consumer pain that would eventually lead to sharp recession and unemployment. We're seeing like certain areas having pain, but certain areas aren't. That's why we're not seeing this broad crisis, which is interestingly why I think this recession will be much deeper, because Fed has no incentive to react quickly and fix the crisis. It's more like a slow brewing. So what I realized that probably the first domino to really fall will be inflation. And then, so instead of crushing employment, what they will do, they will crush inflation. They will create a deflationary shock that will eventually, as real rates go up and real wages go up, it will cause people to change their behavior, both in terms of hiring, in terms of taking out loans, in terms of reducing the sizes of their balance sheets, so people have a choice to do so, that eventually it will cause economic pain and payment and employment side. But that is still a bit away. That is, paradoxically, in this cycle, inflation is the first shoe to drop. And that's why I think it's going to be much more pernicious situation than people think, because what's first going to happen, we're going to have something like this. Inflation will be drifting down, but we know that takes a long time for inflation to drift down from 9% to zero. So it's going to be step by step. And all the while, economic numbers are mixed. So there is no reason for Fed to panic. And employment numbers remain strong. No reason for Fed to not only panic, but even stop tightening. By the time they realize that we're heading towards deflationary catastrophe, they'll be too late. There'll be no way to stop it, because when inflation is really negative, you're in liquidity trap. And then it will start hurting economic activity like it did in Japan. I think the situation is probably more similar to actually how we headed into Great Depression in the 30s, in the sense that I think there was a history there of Fed actually raising rates and slowing down economic activity. And I think that's kind of what is happening right now, what is brewing.
Let's talk about hard assets, and particularly gold, because if I look at what's going on now, there's been, just since interest rates peaked back in early November, there's been this meteoric rise in the price of gold, and it looks on the chart like it's set to continue. But if I'm understanding what you're saying, you know, the reason this, I think, is happening is because we've got real interest rates coming back down. But if you're saying inflation is going negative, and you know we're not going to see deeply negative nominal yields, then you must expect, or I'm guessing you would expect, that this gold rally would reverse at some point as the market realizes that inflation is going to collapse completely?
No, I don't think so, because I think, again, Lynn Alden pointed out at the last podcast that while gold might be driven to some extent to real interest rates, I don't think it's completely beholden to them. I feel that the hard asset rally is for real. And I think that honestly, gold rising from 1700 to 1900 is nothing yet. I think we will see $3,000 gold in this cycle.
Wow. Okay. And what's the driver? It's not negative interest rates, obviously, given your other views. So is it geopolitical risk, or what gets us to $3,000?
Well, when people see that when the Fed is forced to reverse and start adding liquidity, I think because the gold still operates, I think hard assets like gold are kind of prescient. It's almost like gold is not operating on the current liquidity, but anticipation of future liquidity. Gold is kind of, you're seeing gold like an oracle who sees there is money on the horizon. It might be a year from now, but the wall of money is coming, because there will be no choice for the Fed but to start printing money again from a year from now. I think that's what the gold is telling us. And the moment we see interest rates cuts start, and the moment the new conversation about QE starts, and I don't see those things as at all avoidable, I think we're going to have a big rally on this cycle. And honestly, gold did pretty well at the end of tightening cycle of 07, 08. And that was not a peak gold. I think peak gold was like in 2011, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact date, but...
Something like that, right? So gold did really well through tightening cycle through 2004 to 2007. It had some volatility, but then it proceeded up to make new highs. And I think we kind of said, this is, I think, the setup. It might do well at the end of tightening cycle. It might be a little shaken up if we're really having like a sharp asset collapse, but we might not get that sharp asset collapse because there is no systemic over-leveraging and stress. This is more like a slow eradication of excess cash, which will Fed will have to counter. And as the Fed starts countering it, gold will be the thing to buy. So I think I'm honestly inclined to think I have more confidence in oil than in gold right now because there are more underlying like demand that supports oil, right? But also, I think it has all hard assets have pretty good upside from here.
Now, if I think about how the gold market used to work, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the very widely held belief among investors, well, you know, the gold equities, the mining shares tend to lead the metal higher because the smartest money knows what's coming and they're diving into the mining shares before the metal moves higher. If anything, what we've seen is an incredible, just vibrant rally in the price of the metal. And the mining shares are lagging way behind in terms of percentage appreciation. What's going on there?
Well, that would be going into mining analysis. I think there is maybe certain amount of, mining sector could be hurt somewhat by the funding costs, right? Because they do need to do long-term investments and the interest rate cost is a big portion of that. This is the sector that, as far as I understand, stepped on its own feet quite a bit. There was a lot of like wrong decisions made by I'm not talking about specific gold miners, but by the sector. But I think that there is a great opportunity in the sector.
Alex, we're speaking just an hour or two after the Fed released their press statement. We saw a spike up, which is what we saw on the last inflation print, and it took us just briefly over the 50% retracement level of the entire move down from the 4,800 highs down to the bottom. We're just about 50%, and actually, as we've been speaking, it's come back down below that. What's going on here? Are we about to move even higher on stocks, or what's driving it?
Well, as I have mentioned before, asset prices are driven a lot by liquidity, and the liquidity situation is currently positive, partially because of technical factors, and partially as the market will perceive the Fed to be more dovish, which personally, again, as we discussed, I think is unavoidable. There will be some tailwind to stock market, but on the other hand, there will be headwinds in the next few months coming from this liquidity situation, specific liquidity technicals reversing, and at the same time, the background of quantitative tightening for as long as it goes, the background of rising real interest rates will probably put some pressure on earnings and on growth. So there is a lot of like two-sided scenarios. I think I would probably go outside the US, more likely to Europe, to invest in stock markets, like to be heavily long stock market, if I had to be long stock market. My personal stance is somewhat cautious on stock markets. I think at the last time when I talked to you, we talked about my indicator, which is interest rate momentum, the change in 10-year interest rate yield over 2-year horizon. It's still negative, but it's improving pretty rapidly if you look at those charts. So the outlook is improving, but that's an outlook for 2 years from now. Meanwhile, a lot of bottoms can be hit between now and then. So I feel that with regards to stock market, if you really love something, you want to own it, but I would not stretch right now with this rally personally.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Hante Investments. You're a fund manager for our institutional and accredited investor audience who are able to invest in hedge funds. How do they contact you? And also, just give us a reminder, your last book was called The Trades of March 2020. What's in the book and what can people expect to learn from reading it?
Correct. So yes, so my website is www.honteinv, INV like invest, right? honteinv.com, and where you can find most of information about our fund available to public. And if you are qualified, if you pass the legal requirements, you could go inside and get more information. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Igorevich23. And on Twitter, I also have links to my website and to any publications. My most recent book, which came out about a year ago, is called, as you said correctly, The Trades of March 2020. And it delineates my experience of trading through the events of the early pandemic. Kind of like I compared it for a medical student, a chance to step into the operating room and see what is really going on with life kind of real-time chats, what were people saying at that time, actual trading records, what was happening, all the commotion, all the amazing things. I think people might particularly be interested in reading what I wrote at the end of the book about implications of liquidity and how that played out, and see what things I've been wrong or right about in terms of my perception of the post-pandemic world. That would be, I think, very... And I am not at all claiming that you will find me being right. You might laugh at some of the things I said back then, or you might find some of them interesting. But I think that that moment in history was so important and so kind of formative for any trader. It would be very interesting to revisit and like think about trading through the crisis.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Alex back on the show. Now, joining us again in the postgame is Nick Galarnik. But before we get to the charts, Eric, what did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I think Alex's bearish scenario for crude oil prices really bears a lot of consideration because, frankly, the scenario where it turns out that we've just got plenty of oil and there's no problem or something, I just don't see how I could possibly be that wrong about reading this market and this situation in terms of the fundamentals. The argument that Alex makes and other people have made before is, well, hey, wait a minute. Crude oil is so essential to the global economy that if there's not enough of it to grow the global economy, that throws us into a global recession, if not global depression, and that's got to be deflationary. So maybe you get into a situation where the economy gets so bad because of lack of availability of crude oil that you end up with low prices just because the economy is damaged so badly that it can't afford to drive prices up. I think that is a plausible scenario. It's not my base case at all, but I can't see it being what happens first. In other words, I could imagine a shortage of crude oil driving prices crazy high, those crazy high prices crashing the economy and then getting stuck into that deflationary trap. But I think prices have to go higher, significantly higher, before they could go lower for the reasons that Alex described in this interview.
Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Alex's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, Nick, let's get to talking some charts. On page two, we have the S&P 500. Let's start with you. What levels are you watching now that the S&P 500 has broken to the upside here on the post-FOMC?
Yeah, Patrick, that was quite a move we had yesterday. A beautiful move to the upside. So right now, as I speak, spot is around 4150, 4160. Expected move again for the February 17th OPEX is about 110 points, so about 2.65% either direction. Upper expected move there is 4260. With strong resistance now broken at 4,000 and the 4120 resistance broken as well, those should act as support. If we break back below them, obviously, you can flush back down. The lower expected move is 3940, and support again is at 4,000 now, then 3800, then 3700, then the October lows acting as very heavy support at 3500 or so. Now, Eric, what are you thinking about the S&P right here?
The FOMC statement took the S&P back above 4150, which is the 50% retracement point of the big move down from 4800 down to the bottom. Now, the only time since the market bottomed that we've gotten up to this level was the CPI print a month ago, but December 12th CPI was just an intraday spike that very quickly retraced. What we saw here was only a very small amount of retracement after putting in the high of the day on Wednesday. As of Thursday early morning before the open, we're still holding, as I speak right now, 41.51 on the S&P, just about on that 50% retracement number. So big picture, it seems to me there are three possibilities here. Number one, this is a bear market rally that fails right here around the 50% retracement point. Scenario number two, this is a bear market rally that fails at or near the 61.8% retracement level, which is just above 4,300. Or scenario number three, the bottom is already in and we really have somehow magically achieved a soft landing and the market's headed back towards all-time highs from here. That's not at all my base case. I'm thinking number one or number two, but I really don't have a strong opinion on which, whether we're, you know, done here or going to go up to 4,300 before we're done. We'll see what happens.
That's an interesting take, Eric. What I was watching here was whether or not the central bank meetings were going to actually be a catalyst for potentially changing the trends in this market. And at least initially here, that has not been the case. The upper levels that we were looking at for potential testing was that December high here around just under 4,200, as well as that August high close to 4,300. At this stage, testing those overhead resistance levels seems the path of least resistance. But the bigger question is that, well, if now that we're past most of the earnings and past the central bank meetings, if the market hasn't turned on that, then will this prevailing trend persist in the weeks to come? And is this the story for the month of February? I mean, inevitably, there will be a point where the market will have to check this rally and then we're going to have some sort of a sell cycle. There just seems to be no evidence at this moment that this is imminent. This trend is persistent and we have to first see where the upside exhausts itself before we speculate on short-term downside targets. One of the things that I'm going to be really watching closely is when we inevitably get a dip, how well will the bulls defend it and where the support lines will come in on that. And those are certainly some of the key things to watch. Now, moving on here, Nick, I have the QQQ NASDAQ on page three, and it broke that December high and certainly has come to life. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so as we were saying before, you know, this rally is pretty strong. And I mentioned last week that I thought we'd touch that 310 area, which is there's a gap fill on the chart from September-ish at 310. I believe it's like 84 or something like that. And we're almost there right now. We're at 306 as we speak. So again, looking at the February 17th OPEX, we see spot Q's 306. Expected move is about 12 points in either direction, which is about 3.9%. Now, keep in mind, we've already had Microsoft report, which was pretty poor overall. Tesla beat on the top and bottom. Free cash flow came in a week. Meta came out last night, beat on revenues, light on EPS, but they issued a $40 billion buyback, and that was a huge salvo to the bulls right there. You know, it's up 20% as we speak right now, which is a crazy move for a company as large as Meta, right? Tonight we have Amazon and Google, so that should dictate where we finish off the week. But as of right now, that 310 area is what I'm looking at. Beyond that would be 320, then 330, obviously, which are the previous highs from September and August. Now, right now, the expected move, upper expected move for February 17th is 317.50 or so. And the lower expected move right now is 393.50. Keep in mind that now, if we hold this level, the previous resistance of 296 should act as support. So that should be support followed by 280, 260, and then 254, which are the October lows.
All right, let's talk volatility here, Nick. And one of the interesting things on page four, I have that chart of the VIX, is that we have now broken all of the 2022 lows. I mean, there was on the first days of January of 2022, some of the low prints actually near 16.5. But we're now in the territory of heading back to 2021 lows on the VIX, which were actually when the market was still in an uptrend. I'm finding it actually quite surprising how low volatility has collapsed here. What do you make of all this, and what levels are you watching?
Yeah, so I'm always watching the VIX, and seeing it break that 18 level, I don't know, it's very surprising overall. But again, these bear market rallies can last longer than expected and can burn a lot of the bears in the process. You know, I've noticed a lot of people that I've been speaking to have been shorting the market here, and it hasn't worked out too well for them overall, right? So the spot VIX is about 17.6. Expected daily moves in the broad markets are about 1.1%. And as you mentioned, we're seeing the lowest levels in the VIX in over a year. However, it's important to remember that when we look at the charts of the VIX and it bases at the lows, it typically breaks back to the highs pretty fast, you know, within a month or so. So as you were saying earlier on our discussion on the NASDAQ, it's possible that we do get a pullback at some point. It could be a very rapid pullback, and that could cause the VIX to spike as well. But again, the trend is your friend, and you got to watch the VIX and the S&P and the NASDAQ and see where everything is going, essentially. Now, moving on to page five, we have the US dollar, which broke to a new low post-FOMC. What are your thoughts here, Eric?
Well, Wednesday's closing print looks ominous, to say the very least, like perhaps a new leg lower in this dollar correction or dollar bear market, as it's turning out to become. But FOMC days are also infamous for creating head fakes that reverse within a day or two. So far, it hasn't reversed as of early Thursday morning, but let's wait this out and get a few more closing prints in before we decide for sure that we have a new leg lower in this move down on the dollar.
Yeah, it is actually really interesting that the dollar broke to a fresh low. It's not that the trend that is not going to remain in play, but usually such an overextended move in the dollar often has some form of a reaction, some mean reversion, some sort of a bounce, just to check the decline in the dollar. And this seems to continue to be incredibly persistent. I mean, this continues to be a tailwind for so many risk assets. And really, if this continues down towards the bottom end of 2022 lows, that would continue to actually feed almost all of the different risk markets to continue in the prevailing trends. Right now, one of the things that I'm going to be watching is in the post-ECB period, whether or not things like the euro can advance meaningfully north of 110 and hold it, just as further evidence. I think that we really just need to see how all these currency markets settle down as all these major central banks have all just been releasing. But if this trend is still persistent next week, we're going to have to ask some very important questions as to what's next here for many of these different markets.
Let's move on to gold on page six. Now, we're nearing that 2000 level, which I've been eyeing for a while now. What are your thoughts here?
Well, you got a nice chance to buy 1915 before the Fed sent it all the way back above 1970. And Alex isn't the only one who sees the possibility of this cycle taking us all the way up to 3000. Saxo Bank said the same thing in their Outlandish Calls piece at the very beginning of the year. It feels overdue to me for a more substantial correction, but frankly, it's felt that way for the last $100 of upside, so I won't hold my breath. Something I've been thinking quite a bit about is how badly gold mining stocks are lagging the price appreciation in the metal itself. I asked the CEO of a major gold mining company about that this week, and he told me that the word he hears is there just haven't been many inflows into the funds that hold most of the gold mining shares. One possible explanation is that retail traders are just too beaten down by the broader bear market in stocks to ignite a meaningful rally in mining shares. But central bank buying, meanwhile, is driving the cost of the metal up because, of course, central banks don't buy mining shares. They buy the metal. And it's speculative investors who want the leverage that they get from buying the mining shares who tend to buy the stocks. So it certainly makes an argument that the mining shares are the better buy here and that they will eventually catch up, especially if it turns out that my third scenario is right and we really have seen the bottom of the stock bear market. I think that's unlikely. But if it were the case, that we're headed to new highs in the S&P and we're going to get an economic recovery from here, then certainly there's a long way to go for the miners to catch up to the metal here. And of course, it also invites the possibility of a pairs trade, although frankly, shorting gold against long mining shares seems like a pretty risky move right now, given the momentum that we're seeing in gold.
Yeah, for me, the interesting thing was is that as we approach 1900, which we're now decisively above, it was an important level because to me, that's where if the gold was just simply oversold and just bouncing and retracing much of its prior decline, then we shouldn't have seen any meaningful progress above 1900. But it's been quite the opposite. Gold has not pulled back at any stage, continues to get a tailwind from the weakening dollar and has now consolidated for many weeks above that 1900 level, which continues to demonstrate that the bulls remain decisively in control of this trend. Obviously, Nick, you were referencing those previous highs, obviously resistance at 2000 and somewhere just above 2500. Those all become very realistic short-term upside targets. But it, at some stage, that resistance will cause the rally to be checked. And it will actually be the way that gold consolidates from there that will be the real tell as to whether or not fresh 52-week highs are imminent. Interesting thing is silver as well has been consolidating for several, almost a month now, and is just trying to break out. And that would certainly be something that would be a confirmation if we started seeing almost all the precious metals all engaging into another new advance. It'll be certainly interesting to see if that plays out in the coming days and weeks. Moving on page seven, though, I wanted to just comment on crude oil. I know, Eric, you talked about it earlier at the start of the show. But one of the things I was watching was whether or not that $82 level could be beat. And while crude oil was progressing off of its lows and a couple of solid pushes higher, it hasn't been able to get back into those key trade ranges that were being established in the second half of 2022 in the mid-80s. And so this pattern of that downwards channel of crude oil remains intact. And while I understand the bullish angle on oil, and in fact, I am always looking to see when a new bull trend can begin, if for whatever reason this weakness that we've seen this week remains unchecked, it continues to verify that crude oil is not done its sell cycle. Will that cause a retest of the lows or even a shoot down into the mid-60s to test some previous lows is something that we'll be eyeing. When inevitably crude oil turns into its next bull market, it will be a significant technical and macro event. But at this stage, the chart just continues to be incredibly weak and no sign of that bull that we've been looking for as a start. The last thing, though, on page eight I wanted to just show was that 10-year Treasury futures. I know we usually look at the yield, but you know, one of the interesting things is that on the post-FOMC, that little flagging formation is trying to bullishly break out. The question here is, are we going to see some new impulse of the Treasury bonds running higher and yields getting pressed down? It certainly looks like a breakout. One of the things we'll be watching into next week is whether or not this breakout sticks and whether we see a fresh multi-week high, which could send the 10-year Treasury note futures up towards 118 to 120. Certainly a trade that I'm going to keep my close eye on.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the chart deck or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better.
For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.